Nordic Sustainable Economy Podcast Series, delivered by Nordic Council of Ministers.
Hello, good day. You are listening to the Nordic Sustainable Economy Podcast by the Nordic Council of Ministers. Lovely noon here today in Estonia. It seems our galaxy is doing fine, Earth spinning on its axis, and the sun has risen once again, somewhere behind clouds today in Tallinn. Raining a little bit and people busy with their daily lives. The bigger the perspective, the easier one's personal life challenges. Podcast today is of a planetary magnitude, titled Sustainable Growth or Steady State Economy. We shall talk about the economy not in the light of 1 or 2 years up and down prognosis, but look at its potential for true transformation beyond green growth, meaning that the green transition only is a stepping stone for much more fundamental change ahead. We shall see what is lurking behind the magic term sustainable growth and whether sustainable growth or steady state economy is the way forward. In studio, Kaarel Ots, head of Nasdaq Tallinn Stock Exchange and acknowledged public speaker and columnist in Estonia.
Hi.
And David Kolster, postdoctoral researcher, PhD Economics and Sustainability Science in Stockholm Resilience Center. And as the 50th anniversary of Limits to Growth is approaching, it's important to mention that he is currently engaged with a report by the Club of Rome within the project Earth for All. And I'm Madis Stilga, advisor in the Nordic Council of Ministers. We shall first dive into the neoliberal growth and market narrative to see where do we come from and what is playing in our minds. And then we discuss alternatives like steady state economy and the potential of neo-economic narrative that should better serve the society. So if you allow me, I'll just give you a brief preface and then get your reactions. We have come to understand that the type of economy we have and have had since the Industrial Revolution has brought us tremendous benefits, but also destroying the basis of our life. We know that we're taking more than the capacity of Earth systems. Some reasoning why we have it like this is suggested by Kate Raworth on the genesis of neoliberalist economics and how that was constructed by Mont Pelerin society and how strongly it affects our understanding of the relations between economy and society. It was as if economy was functioning in a lab environment without external implications. Some economists wanted the economy to be like physics, hence the rhetoric of forces and mechanisms, trying to convey that economy works along similar universal principles, like laws of nature. In 1947, in a Swiss village of Mont Pelerin, a small band of economists like Hayek and Milton Friedman met with the goal to rewrite economic story. Neoliberalism was born. It took off 1980s, and now for the last 40 years we've been told that markets are always efficient, so give it free hands. State is incompetent, push them back. Trade is win-win, so open the borders. Commons are tragic, so sell them off. Society, just ignore, and finance is never wrong. So I give you this preface, and do you agree with the reasoning, and do you see the same rhetoric at play with our decision makers and economists today?
Yeah, it's Kate Raworth. If listeners don't know, Kate Raworth has written a brilliant book. It's called Donut Economics. I've read it, and I think it's one of these books that I have underlined the most. The other one was Eisenstein's Climate, the New Story, that gives a lot of food for thought. I tried to recall something I read from this book, and I don't think Kate Raworth is a neoliberal. Far from it. I think she wants to unbundle basically what we have seen, you know, around this neoliberalism. But I mean, I'm no scientist. My take is such that, or has been building up to something like the following. The more we try to frame systems, whether it is a capitalist system or liberal system or communist system or neoliberalist system or socialist system, the more we dig ourselves a hole, because usually I believe it's overlapping. You know, many people would argue that, you know, where are we living now? Are we living in a liberal system? You know, definitely parts of the world are considering themselves liberal. Some are communist. But I see that we have been moving quite at a fast pace towards a socialist regime. You know, many people don't like it. They say, what's wrong with it? But if you now start to figure that, you said that the things you, Matis mentioned, Kate Raworth is explaining that these are parts of a play. You know, the state is incompetent, leave it out, the market, you know, whatever, knows better, so give it free hands, etc., etc. So now let's think about it just for a minute. Is it so that the market is efficient? And is it so that you know, state is incompetent and we should leave it out? Now, I think you know, there's truth to both. But when we what we see is that you know, the state in many parts of the world that are capitalist countries have seen the state's part in business and economy increasing over the years. Also in Estonia, so our public sector has been growing. And my question is that. That is it. Well, I mean, what is it if it's not a socialist movement? For example, if you know, we are seeing bailouts. Whenever there is a crisis, most of the crises are due to the state spending too much. The inflation we are seeing now is due to states borrowing too much, due to printing money they don't have. The check is given to the, you know, the common people. So basically, the inflation is a tax. So now we are in a situation where. There are certain companies that are bigger than you know, the world. They're worth trillions. Are we still talking about an efficient market? Is it still you know, possible for all companies to enter if it's controlled basically by a few? In Standard & Poor's 500, there are six companies that are worth more, or that their weight is more than one quarter. More than 25%. Out of 500 companies in the world's most famous index, six count for more than 25%. How efficient is it, the market? I mean, I'm not a socialist, mark my word. I believe, you know, the capitalist, you know, thinking has more benefits. But in a world where, you know, every once in a while, usually every 10 years or so, we have a major crisis that is usually due to inefficient market and usually due to state meddling in the economy that need the taxpayers basically to review their budgets, basically to pick up the check. And I see this, you know, Ayn Randish, Atlas Shrugged, tendency, where state seems to know better how to run the economy and run businesses. And I stop here for now.
Yeah. David, we can get your reactions to that.
Yeah, right. Thank you, Carol, for bringing up Kate Raworth. I also very much like the donut economics, not at least by its reach. It has really popularized this new way of thinking. I think that combining the planetary boundaries as kind of the threshold for humanity that we have to stay within in order to ensure sustainability of our societies, and then combining that with social goals. And I think that that should be the picture for a sustainable economy. So not only focusing on staying within planetary limits, but also having an economic and societal model where we ensure basic needs are met and the capabilities of the people are met. But when we say that markets are most efficient way of handling everything in society, there is a risk here of how do we measure that? Because we measure what we value, but we all also start to value what we measure. So how we measure the economies nowadays is typically by GDP per person or GDP, the total income of the society. But that then we only reflect the market values of things. So then if we only look at market values, of course, the market is most efficient in providing high market values. Where, I mean, it should be by theory, while in reality, this is not really happening. And why is it, so? Because things are not priced correctly. That's kind of the general economic answer to that. That there's a lot of external effects. So if I pay a if I buy a product, let's say I buy a cup of coffee, I'm not really paying the real price of the coffee because there's external effects of that coffee being produced. For example, transportation, there could be carbon footprint, and so on and so forth. And many of those external costs are not accounted for by the markets. So and a fast answer to that is, yes, we need to price things right. We need to put taxes on things that have harmful effect on the environment and so on. But that's also, that also leads to a skewing of the market, and it's difficult to predict and assess exact values because of this. So where I'm going with this is that, yes, markets may be efficient in many ways, but not always. And also when it comes to provision of public goods, markets are not efficient, the most efficient way of doing this, as we have. So here society needs to step in and provide for a lot of different public goods.
So is that you, David, suggesting that when market functions, it certainly can set prices, pretty much everything that comes to the market, but not all the values can be priced. I mean, even let's say if we take the sustainability environmental side, which quite recently now only has been popping up, and this is again the situation where state is meddling with the market because it's setting its rules and goals and restrictions. So that's like in a way pursuing the values rather than the prices. What the state is doing. So it's like the question between the price and value on the market, and of course the externalities as you mentioned.
Right, but also the problem also with setting values, that's also based on kind of the economic paradigm that we can set exact values. So basically, if we believe that there is a marginal harm of this cup of coffee that I buy, then we can set an exact price of that harm to account for it. And I will consume a little less coffee and we will use that money to compensate the environment and so on, and in some way. The problem with that line of thinking is that we are, when we look at ecological systems, we are approaching different types of tipping points with runaway behavior as an effect. So there is kind of no really, there's really difficult to assess a marginal cost of something. And also if we are beyond the tipping point and set forth a self-reinforcing behavior of runaway climate change, for example, there is no way to account for that really. The marginal cost would be so huge for just anything to being produced in a way. So that's one effect, the runaway cost, but also there's a lot of uncertainty in this, right? We don't know exact what will happen to the environment. We don't know exactly. We know we have precautionary principles and we have the planetary boundaries framework adding to carbon, biodiversity, water use, and so on and so forth as a way to try to better understand what we're dealing with when we talk about the environment. But we cannot really say and set an exact number of this is how much it costs and this is what we need to account for. So therefore, we need to think of different ways of organizing our economy, I think. And it doesn't mean that we need to leave all principles of the markets. No, rather the market behaves well in some parts of society and not so well in others, for example. But also, I really like your, Carol, thoughts in a way of what society are we living in? Are we living in a capitalist society? So in a like pure capitalist society where everyone is like self-maximizing their own benefit, like the Ayn Rand or type of society, are we behaving in that way? Are we really doing that in most of our life? What is making our lives worthwhile? Most people would say being with my partner, spending time with my family, having vacation and a lot of different things that are maybe not really in line with the typical like self-maximizing way of thinking. How do we choose our partner? Are we choosing partner by maximizing, comparing the different players at the market, and we're choosing the best one? This will be my partner. Is that how love works? I don't think so. So I think that a lot of our behaviors in society are not governed by a capitalist way of thinking. So when someone argue that we live in a pure capitalist economy, I'm not sure about that. I think we are far from that. And that's also because of the very human and collective way of thinking that we have in our minds. So the capitalist rhetoric is focusing a lot on competition. But I think as humans, we have also developed and also by our evolution to focus very much on cooperation as well. So the market has to, and the economy has to combine cooperation with competition.
I completely agree. And you also brought up this this GDP. And Madis mentioned, you know, growth and et cetera. So I've been also thinking around this that I think we are like on autopilot. I mean, I feel it. And we are so used to reading from the, you know, economic newspapers, you know, every once in a while, every quarter, what is the central bank saying about the GDP, either prognosis or how we did. And this, we are talking about one number that is basically a result of what the businesses are doing. No businessman you know, creates a business just to create growth. Growth is something that happens. GDP is a calculated, it's a mathematical model, basically, that doesn't say anything, really. Okay, it says something, but about, you know, how people are living, for example. And I've been, you know, this is also a pretty you know, un-capitalist way of thinking and you know, heading the stock exchange, which is basically the heart of market economy. You know, for some people, it may a little bit contradict, but I explain what I mean. I think even though we seem to be on an autopilot, trying to measure everything, when we start speaking about sustainability, the biggest difficulty, in my view, is to get rid of thinking of that we, as human beings, are able to measure everything. If we start to believe that we can measure everything, and we have been thinking this for, you know, almost 100 years, then we can put a price tag on everything. Then we have really no future. Whatever we are seeing now, you know, around the CO2 quota, this is all cosmetics. I have a quote here. It's in Estonian. I try to translate it. It's from Gregory Bateson. And he said that if you put God outside of nature and believe that you are created according to his face, then it's logical to say that you are, you know, completely different from the outside world, that the relationship with nature does not have a moral or ethical attention to you whatsoever. And the whole environment is for you to exploit. And if your relationship with nature is such, and if you are using, you know, high-tech technology, then your likelihood to survive is the same as for a snowball in hell. And I think this wraps up very nicely that unless we start thinking of us human beings as part of the world, not the managers or exploiters of the world, we are not achieving anything. We are going to make millions, if not billions, of people poor when trying to, through administrative ways, fight the climate change, which in essence is, I believe, wrong way to look at it. Because, I mean, very many people have said that we are in war. People, you know, so many people like to be in a state of war. George Orwell wrote about state of war, that, you know, for totalitarian regimes, you have to be in a total state of war. It doesn't matter, you know, if the war is actual or not. I mean, just to think about it. Through years, we have had obviously the world wars. The first one was the war that should end all wars, which was followed by an even bigger one. Then there was a brief period of peace. Not everywhere, of course. We had war on drugs, war on terrorism, war on a virus, and now we have a war on climate. I believe that if we learn anything from history is that that there is usually not one party that wins these wars. But on paper, yes. But usually there are many people who suffer from these wars. And Charles Eisenstein, is the book I mentioned earlier, this Climate, the New Story. He's one of the greatest thinkers, I believe, around this topic, that he's saying that, you know, what we also see almost on daily basis, that the climate change does not equal temperature, right? But it's easier to think so. Yeah, we have, you know, melting ice, therefore climate change. But it's a much, much wider topic, and it's much more complex. But the more complexity, the more difficult it is to cover it also in the newspapers. And it's more difficult to be either pro or against whatever, you know, thought or action. And, you know, we are like experiencing this tunnel vision that we mentioned, I think we all mentioned Kate Raworth and the donut economics. I mean, she lists there certain, I actually have a picture of it. I can read for the.
I think this carbon tunnel vision is an established term already.
But just to understand that, what are we talking about? This, what are we lacking in many parts of the world? What this donut should or how this new economic model should address is, you know, health, food, water, energy, networks, housing, you know, social equity, political voice, peace and justice. This is all what everybody wants, really. And then there is this outside of the donut, is the climate change, ozone layer depletion, air pollution, biodiversity loss, land conversion, freshwater withdrawals, etc.
Planetary boundaries.
Exactly. Yeah. But what we are talking about, we are CO2, right? But we, you know, everybody can look up what is a natural CO2 cycle. The cycle is, the Earth has survived for, you know, hundreds of millions of years. More. We are not talking about when we are, you know, fighting this war. We are only talking about CO2. We are all paying enormous, you know, energy bills because of the CO2. And it seems like this is the only way how human beings can tackle the challenges, you know, from the climate change. But it has nothing, you know, okay, I'm wrong, it's not nothing, but usually nobody talks about biodiversity. Usually, I'm not talking about, you know, consumption, you know, how much people are spending. And I usually, when I speak about these things, I ask this question. And with this corona, it's, I think, especially, you know, good to illustrate. I mean, everybody who is listening can imagine what is a coronavirus like. We have seen this picture. You know, it's a ball with these spikes, right? And now imagine that we go to sleep at night, and in the morning we wake up, and by magic, the whole world has been turned into a renewable energy consuming world. What does this world look like? I would say from space, it looks a lot like this coronavirus. Why? Think of all the wind turbines it needs to have. Basically, the world would be full of them. And now the question is, guess this magic really happens. Does it then mean, and I don't have the answer to this, does it mean that now we have reached our goal? Now humans have won the war on climate change just because we have moved entirely to renewable energy. But we keep spending exactly how we have been spending since the 50s, 60s, 70s, till today.
Yeah. So we maintain our lifestyles and try to carry on with just the green stuff.
Exactly. And this is why I have a big problem with this way that this fight is organized. It's an administrative, it's from the public sector, and it is targeting one thing mainly. And the cost, what we were talking about earlier, the cost with crisis is usually picked up by, you know, the general folk that have really very little to do with how we ended up here.
I think I should say that at least to my humble opinion, the scope has widened a little bit. So people are talking more about the nature itself, the biodiversity. It's not that much about the carbon only. But on the other hand, I understand why it was launched like this, because as you describe, this coronavirus image is in front of us, it sort of makes it so focused that this is the enemy. So it's also very good communication to make this carbon an enemy. Which carbon is not an enemy. Carbon is a life-building material. It just happens to be in the wrong place, in excess.
Yeah, but still, if I may, I mean, when I think of a business, of any business, then usually businessmen don't do anything without a goal. They have a plan. Then they see whether they have resources, how much they cost, and then they set sight on this goal. And I haven't understood, what is the goal? Has anybody really articulated what is the goal of the so-called green transition or the Green Deal? We all know that this is a major goal. We are spending, billions and billions, and usually, again, regular people are paying this bill. What is the goal? This is the good saying, I think it was from Daniel Kahneman. Also, it was for businesses. You know, everybody knows what a post-mortem is. You know, from somebody dies, you figure out what was wrong. And he says that it should be a pre-mortem. You think of all the ways that can go wrong on a journey towards any goal, right? And try to write them down. So to try to predict, all the challenges that there might be. I'd ask the same in year 2035 or 2050. That have been used heavily in this Green Deal messaging. What's the goal? How do we measure success? How do we know that we have been successful? How do we know that we failed? It's, 30 years. I should be alive. We all are alive then.
David, this is your response now. How we know that we've made it?
Yeah, how do we know that we made it? I agree that we need to expand our scope beyond carbon, but I don't think that we focus enough on carbon. I think we need to focus on the others as well. But I think that we may talk a lot about carbon. But yes, we need to apply a systems perspective, a complex systems perspective, when understanding the different relationships. But when it comes to carbon, it is actually quite easy in a way. That it's quite straightforward what we need. The problem is that we are digging up fossil fuels and we're burning fossils. So we are altering the carbon cycle that has been existing for a very long time. But when it comes to the question of where are we going, I think that Kate Raworth is offering a compass that this is where we want to go. And in quite recent research, me and a few colleagues at Stockholm Resilience Center, we were looking at different regions and where capabilities, human capabilities, are met. And we found that there is a quite consistent level of around $15,000 per capita. At that level of GDP in the world, human capabilities are met. The core human needs and capabilities are met. And this also coincides with the level that happiness economics have found, that at this level, more income does not bring more happiness. So one term that, based on the Kate Raworth way of thinking, Catherine Trebeck and Williams have written a book called The Economics of Arrival. So where are we heading? And in this book, they are answering this, that this is the goal, basically. So we have focused for 100 years, maybe a bit less, at least, I mean, according to the picture that Madis was drawing in the beginning here, we have focused very much on growing the economies. But now we actually have arrived. The economies are big enough. And like Carol said, now we need to maybe reduce consumption. We have arrived. Now we have to make ourselves feel at home. That's the rhetoric that they use in the book. And how do we make ourselves feel at home? We shift the focus on maximizing income, maximizing profit, maximizing GDP, which still very much is the focus of the society at large. And we turn to look at the inner circle of the donut and try to understand, how do we actually create well-being? How do we increase the happiness of the society, etc.? So I think that is a beautiful picture of the goal. And it's not... In that way, reducing emissions and removing emissions, that is part of the way, but it's not the goal in itself.
Yeah, but still, I mostly agree with you. Where I don't agree is that when you say that we have arrived, it's a very broad statement. I believe that even in a one country, people have a very different understanding of whether they have all arrived or whether they would like to arrive in a different place.
Mm.
From an economic point of view, it's very difficult for me to see a country that is now stepping up and saying that we have arrived, just to use the same definition, and we don't want to grow any longer. Let's take the number one capitalist country in the world, the United States. They have increased their public debt to 100% of GDP. You know, people may ask, you know, so what? It was as high as this after the Second World War. It has never been higher. Economists have said, calculated, that if this figure increases over 90%, then it makes it more difficult, if not impossible, for the countries or for the leaders of the country to grow the economy by either increasing the debt or cutting taxes. Because then the debt level is so big in itself that it's a problem to keep paying the interest, basically. How did the United States solve this 100% GDP after the Second World War? It's mainly three things. Of course, it's more, but financially speaking, they had an inflation, which was not something that we are seeing now, but they had an inflation which was higher than the real interest rate. Put it differently, the central bank, or the Fed, was keeping the interest rates lower than the inflation rate. Plus, the third component was growth. They had great, resilient growth after the war. Bring this to today's world. Money has been, this is a wrong saying, the money has been printed. It's actually, you know, in computers we have added zeros to the central bank, but or the balance. But growth we really haven't seen. It's really stagnant. There is a high debt level. The interest rates have been almost zero for many, many years. And the inflation is now in consumer price indexes or consumer prices. But it was also before, present. Everybody who is an investor understands that their portfolio has been, you know, supported by strong, strong headwinds. Basically, it means inflation is in assets, right? It's real estate and stocks that have increased in price. So it's not working anymore. The countries are not able to decrease the debt level. And my question is, if the countries are in this situation as they are now, for example, our government, I might be wrong, but I think we have like 80% of the yearly budget is basically booked for all kinds of costs that we are not able to change. And if we now say that, our GDP per capita is on this level that we have now achieved what we are to achieve, I think it's nearly impossible to sell it to the public, because usually we see that quite the contrary during elections, that politicians are promising the voters whatever, basically, and then we know that we have like a 15% to 20% maneuvering room if the businesses are growing, if the GDP is growing. Otherwise, there will be no taxes. And I mean, I understand perfectly well what you are meaning, David, and where we this ideally should be moving. But keeping in mind that we are, in a sphere, on a sphere. So if we, are the first, like the European Commission wants to be, the first running with a flag, to become carbon neutral the first in the world. My question is, how does it correspond to the world climate? I might be wrong with the percentages, but I think the European Commission's CO2 emission is less than 10%. Now, if others don't follow, then it's very difficult to see how, for example, our grandparents who are now paying, you know, three or four times more for energy, how their suffering really helps the planet, because the general goal should be to you know, make life sustainable on planet. And on a life, I don't mean our life. And this is, you mentioned that, and I agree, more and more people are talking about biodiversity, nature, etc. But it's vague and it's abstract. I mean, I don't also want to, you know, see trees cut down, but how does it fit into this picture? Why is it important to talk about consumption? Why is it important that when our CO2 natural cycle depended on forests, soil, and oceans? Why is it important? How does it play into this big narrative if we remove all the forests, cut it down? If we mess with the soil, so meaning that the soil we will not be able to,
sequester
carbon. Exactly. And then the oceans are also full of acid. So I think this is something that is needed, that that we don't just price one component that we have actually came up ourselves.
Yeah. So this is actually a very tricky predicament. I will give you a word, David, right away. So you're suggesting, Carl, that on the one hand, the governments are actually looking for growth because they aren't seeing any. There is no growth available at the rates that we are expecting. So it's already slowing down for various reasons. On the other hand, we realize that on this finite planet, the economies cannot grow forever. So there must be some kind of backing down or slowing down. So this is a really tricky predicament. And I think this is something that we've been exchanging our thoughts earlier as well. Maybe this is now the ripe moment for a kind of a new narrative. Mm. David, your thoughts, please.
No, absolutely. And I think there are some countries that are leading this new narrative. There is a group called the Wellbeing Economy Governments, WEGO, supported by the Wellbeing Economy Alliance. Some countries, including Scotland, New Zealand, I think Finland is part of it, that are trying to have a different view of that, more in line with the Kate Raworth's view and Catherine Trebeck's view of economy of arrival. So I think there are steps in this direction. And they, of course, do not focus on that we need to decrease the GDP. That's not a goal, right? So it's rather being like agnostic about that. The goal is a good society where people's capabilities are met, human needs are met, people are happy. And whether that means a bigger economy or a smaller economy, that's not so important. As long as we have a clear vision of where we're heading and what's important to people. So it's kind of a misunderstanding sometimes with the degrowth movement, for example. I think that there's degrowth in the name. The focus is not to decrease the economy, but that may be a consequence of focusing on other things that are more important in life. And just to answer, I think what Carol said also, that who has arrived? I think that's a very good question. Who has arrived? I think the economy as a large in many rich countries has arrived, but there are people lagging behind. There are people that, for example, in the US case, if you look at lower income, people with lower incomes, they have over the last 30 or 40 years or so not caught up. They have not gotten any part of the growing economy. Inequalities are rising. And with that, a lot of frustration, which I think you can see in the elections and the afterplay of the last election in the US, that is a growing frustration that is based on this polarization of societies and based on increasing inequalities and ultimately based on a fixation of growing the economies very much. So it's this kind of like individualistic thinking that are not, I think, reflecting the the human nature enough. So the economy as they are today, I mean, the growth was seen as a tool to arrive to get to a level where we have enough, and now we can share it among ourselves and create good societies.
So you're also suggesting, David, that economy should be more distributive in nature, but by nature. I mean, as we have these gaps in wealth and this equality issues, then of course the critique comes that are we building a communist type of system?
Right. I mean, I think that we need to talk about distribution, not only redistribution. So why are the incomes distributed the way they are? Why is wealth distributed the way it is today? So it's not only about redistribution, but also like pre-distribution. Why are things working the way they do today?
How could you respond to Karel's notion that would you find now a country that would gladly tell the government of the country, tell their people that, okay, we're now slowing down because we want to bring you other benefits, but we need to scale down our economy in the name of the general sustainability.
Right. I think the countries that I mentioned before, Scotland is one example, are changing the focus in line with this reasoning. So I think, yes, there are examples that of front runners in this, but maybe not sufficient. I mean, of course, not sufficient number of governments, but also not maybe in a sufficient manner as well. But I think there are examples of, and there is, of course, a different degree. I mean, Karel was just saying that he was referring to U.S. as the most capitalistic country, which is probably true in many ways. So it's just to show that there is a scale of different understandings of this.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think it's really, it requires a change in mindset. We haven't always been, a human being has not been equal to a consumer. Mm. This is started in the 50s, from the consumerism movement. And we have been, sold this with mass propaganda. This is a new phenomena that we are supposed to be consumers. This is not true. Why have this issue with, whether it's a neoliberal or capitalist or whatever, when we see that in many, many countries, the government's role in the economy is actually increasing. They know how to run businesses better. Why is it increasing otherwise? There is room, really, to change the direction of their focus. From the financial point of view, if we know that from the budget, we have 80% allocated. So we can only maneuver by 20. But what about the 80%? Is the focus where the public sector is focusing on the right focus? Do we have to do with all these things we are doing? I mean, in Estonia, we have had a debate about the public sector reform of the government reform for many, many years. The reform is not only, decreasing the number in the parliament or whatever, how to look at it narrowly. The question is, and what is also, by the way, mentioned by Kate Raworth, that if we're talking about human rights, you can't let this, leave it to the market to decide. Human rights all over the world is something that the state generally should focus on instead of many of these initiatives that they are focusing on now, arranging, managing companies or doing some, questionable investments, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then when we get this mindset changed, then we can start thinking of how to distribute. And I agree that it shouldn't be just redistributing the existence, but how we can distribute the growth that we are generating. I mean, people will always generate growth. We will always generate growth. Where we are sitting now, it's a private company they are selling newspapers, they are selling conferences, they will create growth. Whether the growth is, you know, the most important issue, this is, I think, up for the debate. And it should be made crystal clear in communication when we talk about the Green Deal or the green transition or whatever transition that is costing us trillions of dollars, maybe tens, I think it was only 100 trillion for the whole world. Why we are doing it? How do we measure it? And, you know, what is really required besides the CO2 pricing? What is really required from the people, from the companies, from the governments?
So that if the state will be able to tell people that instead of pursuing the growth, we will be able to provide you even better welfare.
Then the state is not pursuing growth. That's the main logical fallacy, that the state is not creating any growth. The state expects the companies and the employees of the companies to create growth so that they can redistribute the money they receive. This is wrong mindset that the companies will always be doing this. Now it's a question, how do we use the proceeds of this growth generation?
So you're suggesting that we should not restrict growth as such?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Because, as I said...
How long can we grow?
How long? I mean...
On this planet, I mean.
Yeah. I'll give you a good example. In year 1800, the smartest people on the planet said that we have now reached the ceiling of our growth in the world. It was more than 200 years ago, and the economy, or the whole world then, has been growing more than 80 times since then. I don't think we will have a ceiling anywhere soon. The companies will change, the business structures will change, and people are, I think, by definition, ambitious. Mm. Very many people are. They can't just sit still and do nothing, at least the entrepreneurial people. And always growth follows. Now it's a question, what do we do with it? Do we need, so centralized states? It's a good question, I think. We don't have time to go into this, but I think one thing that has changed, and not for the good, is the loss of communities. The communities all over the world, they would know how to take care of nature, how to take care of, where they live. All this centralization to, moving to cities, giving our powers away, giving the freedoms away, just to, for a handful of people.
You're being detached from your footprint, actually.
Exactly.
When you live in a community and you're cutting down your forest or you're doing something with your water supply in the nearby pond, then obviously you... immediately feel the
I feel the
impact.
Pain. Exactly.
The pain, exactly. But now it has been put away in a global economy, especially far, far away is the footprint. So for the local community, I think they will recognize when we should put a limit to the growth. But in this global community, it is really difficult to catch that. David, I also should say that we have a few minutes till the end. Time is ruthless on us. But David, your thoughts on this still this growth potential? Can we ever get rid of this? Is it why should we get rid of the growth when it's so closely tied to the human ambitions and ideas?
Right, but I don't think. It is actually. So I think that growth may, as societies have been for the last 40, 50, 100 years, maybe growth has been connected, correlated very much with creativity, with the human brain and expansion of thinking and new ideas, etc. But we don't need to tie that to growth per se. I don't think that it's reflecting growth in the societies we are living today and have been living in. But in the future, it will not. In fact, the modeling I'm working on at the moment, I believe that the world will continue to grow in GDP per person income levels, basically. But societies will not continue to grow, and the global GDP will not continue to grow simply because there will be fewer children in the future. So I think that the world population will stagnate and start to decline within this century. And that means that the production, the total production, will have to go down. So we will see less economic activity, basically. Growth will be negative within this century that we're seeing.
When by your research, I've also seen some graphs when the population, starts to decrease. When is it, according to your model?
It's before the end of the century, and it's in within a few decades, I would say. So this is something that we're just finalizing at the moment. So I will be able to give a response to that in a couple of months. But we believe it's much sooner than the UN projections, for example, guess. And then we will basically have negative growth in very many societies in the world. We will have to have that, basically. But that does not mean that there will be less human needs met or human capabilities met. That depends on how the incomes are distributed. And for every person, the income may still rise. But at the large, on the societal level, the countries will be smaller. But I also want to add that yes, I think that centralized governance is useful in many ways, but we also need to think about different levels and polycentric governance. Recently, we talked a lot about climate here. Recently, we have the citizen assemblies in many places, and the EU has also organized these citizen assemblies where people are drawn by lot, basically. People are elected to a parliament or to a body that is then giving suggestions to government. And I think we should think about societies in many ways and the governance, governments in many ways. And also when it comes to it's not only privately owned companies. That's not only the only way of doing things. There's a lot of different ways of organizing production. We have a lot of big cooperatives. We have state-owned companies that are working quite well. We have so there are different ways, and there is not for profit businesses that are running and that are very big in the economy. So they, I think they also provide another ethos of the value, what value means, and where we want the economy to grow.
Thanks. Here I have to cut in, and just for the last minute, Karel, if you can, the financial institutions, how will they change? You have 1 minute.
Yeah, no, thanks for that. I don't know. This is the honest answer, because I think we will have. First, to see what will happen with the economy we are in. I think it has been unsustainable for a few years now. What will happen with all the debt levels? Whether we will see
more community-based finance?
This has been present really in some countries more than others. Whether we will see some new currencies popping up. Whether we will see changes in the current reserve currency structure, I don't know. But I want to believe that this tendency of people to explore, to do things in a new, different way, to be entrepreneurial, and also for people to invest into these ventures, this will not change.
Okay. Thank you very much, David and Karel. That was most interesting. The time we could have much more on us on this very complex issues. And that was the last episode of this season. I hope to be back later in the year with some more new. Kindly visit once in a while norden.ee for things happening in Estonia, or norden.org for our international hub. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Nordic Sustainable Economy Podcast Series, delivered by Nordic Council of Ministers.